You are listening to an ADIS Journal podcast.
Welcome to this podcast. I'm Melissa Johnson, thoracic oncologist at Sarah Cannon Research Institute. I'm a phase one drug developer in Nashville, Tennessee, USA.
Thank you, Dr. Johnson. Happy to join this panel today. I'm Jessica Lin, a thoracic medical oncologist at Massachusetts General Hospital. I am also a phase one investigator as well.
Lovely to be here, Dr. Lin and Dr. Johnson. My name is Adrienne Boire. I'm a physician scientist at Sloan Kettering. I'm a neuro-oncologist and I specialize in metastasis to the central nervous system.
Thanks so much for asking me to participate in this panel. My name is Milan Kandikar. I'm a radiation oncologist at the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. I treat lung cancer and brain metastases.
Well, let's jump right into our discussion. Let's start with discussing the current treatment landscape. What's the incidence of brain metastasis in lung cancer, and how significant is this disease burden in particular? We'll start with Dr. Boire.
I'm happy to start us off. The true incidence of central nervous system metastasis is notoriously hard to establish because, of course, we would need an autopsy as a gold standard. But in general, we estimate that the incidence of CNS metastases in non-small cell lung cancer is on the order of about 40 to 50% of all patients. Of course, it's higher in certain subpopulations and is thought to be higher in patients harboring HER2 mutations as well as EGFR mutations.
Yeah, I would just add that across different molecular subsets of lung cancer, it looks like we're seeing different rates of brain metastasis reported. Relevant to this specific podcast, if we consider patients with advanced EGFR mutated lung cancer, and if we examine the data from the more recent phase 3 clinical trials that enrolled this patient population, approximately 40% of the patients appear to present with brain metastasis at their initial diagnosis. And then similarly, if we look at patients who have advanced ALK-positive lung cancer, approximately 30 to 40% have brain metastasis at their initial diagnosis. But the instances are even more striking if we examine the cumulative incidence of brain metastasis throughout the disease course. In ALK-positive lung cancer, based on one retrospective study, we have seen a 73% rate of brain metastasis at 5 years. What is unclear is what leads to these distinct rates of brain metastasis. Does it have to do with the distinct times of survival for the patients? For example, for those patients who have the subset of lung cancer where there are more therapeutic options available and patients are living longer, perhaps they have just more opportunity to develop brain metastasis. Does it really reflect a distinct inherent biology in terms of tropism towards the central nervous system? This is an area of ongoing research where we're hoping to find more answers.
I think what the numbers don't reflect is the impact a diagnosis of brain metastasis has both on the patient and their families. Brain metastasis causes morbidity, neurologic deficit in patients, requiring extra care. For many people, it's a devastating thing to hear that their brain is involved with cancer, and many people view it differently than a metastasis in a bone or the liver or other places. I think underscores how important dealing with brain metastasis is.
Along those lines, Dr. Lin, how do you survey your patients with non-small cell lung cancer for brain metastasis once found?
Currently, NCCN guidelines and ESMO guidelines advised to screen at initial diagnosis of non-small cell lung cancer for brain metastasis, meaning that all patients, when they are diagnosed with non-small cell lung cancer, should be screened. And this should be done using contrast-enhanced brain MRI unless there is a contraindication. There is a potential exemption of stage 1A disease from this recommendation, for example, in the NCCN guidelines. Once brain metastases have been identified, the NCCN guidelines suggest that repeat MRI tests be pursued every 2 to 3 months for the first 1 to 2 years for disease monitoring. And then if there is clinical stability, every 4 to 6 months thereafter. And that is in line with my practice as well. An open question, Dr. Johnson, has to do with routine surveillance for brain metastasis, right? In patients who have non-small cell lung cancer throughout their disease course after the initial diagnosis. There is currently no guideline from ESMO or NCCN on this aspect. When patients do not report any symptoms necessarily concerning for brain metastasis, should we be pursuing routine surveillance? And if so, how often? Dr. Johnson and Dr. Boar, do you have thoughts on this?
I do tend to survey these patients, even in the absence of symptoms, particularly patients with EGFR and ALK alterations. As you say, Dr. Lin, these are patients that are more apt to develop brain metastasis. And so probably every 3 months, and certainly every 6 in a patient that's otherwise stable on their systemic therapy, I'm adding a brain MRI.
My practice, patients all have known brain metastases or leptomeningeal metastases. And in the case of leptomeningeal metastasis, which does tend to have a bit of kind of a more brisk pace, we tend to survey the patients, those patients every 2 months with an MRI brain, MRI spine, and a CSF collection. And this really allows us to be able to capture changes at the pace of which the illness is moving.
Building on that, I think it does come into play in terms of how the brain metastases are being managed, in terms of the pace of growth of metastases, or what we call the velocity, how many are appearing at a certain time. And depending on the treatment strategies, whether they're surveillance or using CNS-directed therapies, it might alter the frequency of that.
That is a great segue to switch gears and let's review the treatment of brain metastasis once they are identified. How are patients with brain metastasis from non-small cell lung cancer managed in general? And are the current treatments effective? Dr. Johnson, would you be able to please guide us and start us off?
Sure. Just as we have assimilated a multidisciplinary panel for this discussion today, I think that's emblematic of the need of all patients with brain metastasis to be considered by a multidisciplinary group that includes both surgical and radiation, locally ablative techniques, as well as medical oncology and neuro-oncology approaches to more systemic treatment. For patients that are asymptomatic, we may have more options because patients are not having immediate risk to their neurologic function. But of course, patients often present with brain metastasis because of neurologic symptoms, and that does require typically surgery or radiation to go first to ameliorate the symptoms. In the absence of symptoms and in the presence of a driver like EGFR or ALK, we have learned that systemic therapies can penetrate the CNS very nicely. And so that gives us time to watch, to treat with an initial TKI. I tend to scan the brain subsequently, fairly quickly, within a month or 6 weeks, to make sure that the treatment is effective in the brain. And I think we are learning with time that maybe there are other therapies that where we can also adopt that approach.
I'll add that as a radiation oncologist, it's been tremendous to see the addition of systemic therapy options, because what we used to consider as sort of having a limited sort of set of tools in the toolbox, I think that careful kind of use of all of these treatments can be very helpful in minimizing the morbidity of treatments, because I think that's something we always try to be cautious of, is trying to maximize disease control, but also quality of life. And so really a careful consideration of the use of local therapies or systemic therapies or both in the situation is really trying to do the best by our patients to try to minimize toxicity.
Dr. Khandelwal, I'd like you to speak to us a little bit about which patients get referred to radiation oncology for evaluation. What are the different radiation options that are available?
I think that involving a radiation oncologist early is usually very helpful. As I said before, I'm very happy to not treat patients. I find that often if it's in the patient's best interest, but knowing kind of the landscape of what the brain metastasis look like at the beginning, maybe before they go on to receive a TKI directed against their genomic driver, before they start chemotherapy, knowing something about what the patient was like before, knowing about how the disease looked before is helpful. And it can be helpful to look from a broad picture. I first divide patients into symptomatic and asymptomatic. I think symptomatic patients should be evaluated for local therapy, both surgery, maybe radiation, depending on the situation. For patients who end up going down a surgical route for symptomatic brain metastasis or larger brain metastasis, we typically would also offer radiation to reduce the chance of recurrence, either postoperatively in the resection bed or a newer approaches, including preoperative radiosurgery before resection. But again, I think that that evaluation is usually done up front. For patients where we're thinking about radiation, to me, the biggest question is, are we going to take a local, a sort of, well, I would say a focal approach, meaning treating individual lesions, or should we take a broader approach, which would involve some form of whole brain radiation? The downsides of that broader approach of whole brain radiation, I think, are well characterized, and it would definitely be associated with some impact on patients' quality of life, on neurocognition. And despite we use things like hippocampal avoidance and memantine to reduce those risks, but I think the biggest decision from a radiation perspective is this someone where their disease is best treated that way. And I would say those are the patients where I'm most excited to see and learn about systemic therapy options that might offer a broader local control in the CNS. In terms of the other choices, when we do focal radiation, we can often do radiosurgery in a single treatment. Sometimes, depending on location or size, we may break that treatment up into multiple treatments. But again, the concept is to treat the individual lesion itself. And I think we sometimes will do that as a combination, maybe treating a larger lesion or one with more edema are more likely to become symptomatic and leaving the others for some form of systemic therapy. So that's why I think the initial discussion up front about the management is very important. And as Dr. Bohr, as you said earlier, sometimes it will mean watching the patient carefully when you start the systemic therapy and then maybe targeting one or more problematic lesions, the bad apples, to take care of those while the bulk of the work is being done by systemic therapy. Again, with the goal overall of making sure we remember that this is the goal of this treatment is to improve not only quantity of life, but quality of life. And this question is really for all of you. I'm wondering if you could describe the systemic therapy options that are available for patients with non-small cell lung cancer and have brain metastases, and maybe give some examples on how you might approach this in different contexts. We can start maybe with Dr. Johnson.
It does seem like as many as 50% of my patients will present with at least one lesion in their brain. It is part of the information that we gather at diagnosis to formulate a treatment plan, along with histology, most commonly non-squamous versus squamous cancer, the presence or absence of drivers, EGFR and ALK, and then the PD-L1 level, which is most relevant for patients that are driver negative or don't have an oncogene driver. Maybe I'll start with my approach to those patients and then pass it over to Dr. Lin for comments about non-small cell with actionable genomic alterations. When I have a patient who's non-squamous, potentially with a brain metastasis, then the question becomes, is it symptomatic or not? And if it's not symptomatic, then I may start the process of developing the systemic plan in parallel with the plan for radiation. And that will take into account the PD-L1 level. I tend to use chemotherapy in combination with immunotherapy for the majority of my driver negative patients. And I will ask my radiation oncologist to sequence in the radiation to the brain metastasis as they're able to plan it, and we'll do it concurrent with treatment. If a patient has a symptomatic brain metastasis, that does trump things. And so usually the radiation oncologist will go first and plan the radiation, whether it be single fraction or a larger, more diffuse whole brain radiation technique. We use that less and less all the time. And then I'd start systemic therapy out back. The obvious reason this is less appealing to me as a medical oncologist is the systemic disease continues to grow during the time it takes to plan the radiation. And so patients come back after whole brain radiation, for example, their performance status has declined and their opportunities for systemic therapy and the intensity that will help them do diminish as if their performance status is no longer as good. Dr. Lin, does that jive with what you do?
Absolutely. It very much does. I would say in patients with lung cancer with actionable genomic alterations, there we are starting to have a lot more comfort in starting out with systemic therapy to address the brain metastasis. And this is because we have an increasing list of CNS penetrating and CNS active targeted therapies. So for example, in patients who have advanced EGFR mutated lung cancer, the first line treatment with osimertinib, a third generation EGFR inhibitor, whether it's given as monotherapy or in combination with chemotherapy, offers really robust CNS efficacy. Just to review the data for osimertinib, FLORA was the phase 3 trial that compared osimertinib against the first generation EGFR inhibitors like erlotinib or gefitinib. This trial was for patients who have treatment naive advanced EGFR mutated lung cancer. And in this trial, the CNS objective response rate with osimertinib was 91% in patients who had measurable CNS metastasis. Furthermore, osimertinib decreased the risk of CNS progression compared to first generation EGFR TKIs. And so we have accumulating data for these CNS active targeted therapies that they are not only able to address the existing brain metastasis effectively, but that they're also able to delay or prevent new brain metastasis from occurring, which has important implications for patients in terms of trying to reduce the morbidity and mortality associated with brain metastasis. There was also the more recent FLORA2 trial in the EGFR mutated lung cancer space. So FLORA2 was the phase 3 trial that compared first-line osimertinib alone versus osimertinib given together with platinum pemetrexed chemotherapy for patients diagnosed with advanced EGFR mutated lung cancer. And here again, we saw excellent CNS objective response rates. Similar to what we're seeing in EGFR mutated lung cancer, we have a growing number of CNS active targeted therapies for patients who have other actionable genomic alterations, such as ALK rearrangements, ROS1 rearrangements, RET rearrangement, TRK rearrangements, MET exon 14 skipping, and the list continues to grow every year. I have to mention the exciting data that were presented from the CROWN trial looking at lorlatinib, which is a third generation ALK inhibitor for patients diagnosed with advanced ALK positive lung cancer. And the reason I think these data are worth reviewing today is because we are starting to get better and better sense of how much CNS efficacy can be achieved with these highly CNS penetrant next generation TKIs. And so in the CROWN trial, we saw that lorlatinib resulted in an intracranial response rate of 82%, with 71% of patients with ALK positive lung cancer having complete intracranial responses. And remarkably, what we saw at the ASCO annual meeting this year is that after 5 years of follow-up, the five-year intracranial progression-free survival rate that was achieved with lorlatinib was 92%. So again, really speaking to the potential for these CNS-active targeted therapies to alter the natural history of the cancer and the ability of the tumor metastasize to the brain.
I agree. I think some of the response rates are truly remarkable. And I'll hasten to add that they're so remarkable in the case of some of drugs such as lorlatinib that occasionally I will have a patient who does not want radiation therapy, despite my counseling that they have perhaps a symptomatic metastasis. And even in the case of a symptomatic brain metastasis, for example, a patient of mine who had seizures, stopped the seizures with antiepileptics, initiated lorlatinib, and this patient has been disease-free for many years now, and we're even able to titrate off the antiepileptics. It's remarkable what these drugs can do when they really work.
I will add that I agree that this has dramatically changed the practice, and I share that enthusiasm, I will say, even though it leads to less radiation, but it certainly and tremendously impressive to see both the depth of response and the duration in many patients. So I do think that maybe a role for that in symptomatic patients, even I think it's a question that will need to be studied, obviously, but I think understanding who those patients are, it's been a very exciting thing to see from the observer standpoint, seeing the success of these drugs in the CNS.
I hasten to add that I wholeheartedly agree that it's important to have the addition of radiation oncology early in the disease course, because I think it's important to establish the relationship, because not every drug is lorlatinib. And they don't all work on every single brain metastasis, and they don't always work forever. And when you have an established relationship with the radiation oncologist, you know the patient well, it's much easier pivot. And it's a much more straightforward experience for everyone. It's not a scientific argument. It's much more of an interpersonal one, but I think that's quite important.
That's a really good point. And I am thinking of a doctor, a radiation oncologist in Kentucky that I have a relationship like that with, a patient that we have shared with an oncogene-driven cancer who's been on a clinical trial with me. The clinical trial has controlled his disease systemically really well. But every once in a while, he'll have a tiny little brain metastasis to develop. Does that mean that the drug doesn't work in the brain? Maybe not. Maybe it doesn't work to the same degree that it does in the body. And so I've found about three times during his time on this one trial, I have called his radiation oncologist and said, hey, we've done a brain scan. We've found a recalcitrant spot. Can you plan stereotactic radiosurgery for me again? And I think that also requires planning and coordination with the clinical trial companies. And while they are always first and foremost trying to understand the activity and the penetration of their drug, I think the flexibility to allow this sort of interdisciplinary care on clinical trials is working in favor of developing drugs with more durability as a result.
I definitely agree. And that's what we see a lot of in our practice is that we are there to sort of catch the ones that escape the sort of general drug therapy and often can prolong the time on an otherwise successful drug with the use of selective radiation. I tell people when I meet them that I don't want to see them again, but I'm there if they need us.
Excellent. So very nice to review the current management options for brain metastasis in lung cancer. Let's move to part two of the podcast, focused on available clinical evidence of intracranial efficacy for antibody drug conjugates, or ADCs, in lung cancer. ADCs, Dr. Johnson, represent a very exciting class of therapeutics these days for patients with lung cancer. In thinking about the potential role of ADCs in the treatment landscape for patients with brain metastasis, do you mind first walking us through what evidence is available for any of the ADCs in terms of intracranial efficacy?
Sure. Remember, Dr. Lin, that these antibody drug conjugates are big molecules. They have three parts, the antibody, the linker, and the payload. And so I remember when we first started having phase one trials of these agents that patients with brain metastasis were not allowed. Patients who had previously had brain metastasis treated might have been allowed as long as disease had been stable. But there was concern that actually these drugs might not be able to penetrate the CNS. And while I think the mechanism by which we're seeing activity in the brain needs to be better elucidated, we started seeing surprisingly good results of these antibody drug conjugates in the brain, starting first with trastuzumab deruxtecan, or TDXD, in a subset analysis that demonstrated the superiority of TDXD over TDM1 for patients in whom brain metastasis were present at baseline, there was improvement in PFS, 15 months versus 3 months for patients treated with TDXD. And in particular, the intracranial response rate for these patients, 65% for patients treated with TDXD and 34% for patients treated with TDM1. The subgroup analysis was the first glimmer that suggested that TDXD might be different in terms of its ability to penetrate the CNS. We've for a long time talked about the disintegration of the blood-brain barrier after radiation as one mechanism by which bigger molecules can get into the CNS. I think we don't yet know if it's just the active part of the drug, the payload, that's permeating through the blood-brain barrier into the CNS. And so I think more work needs to be done in that regard. We've also seen glimmers of CNS efficacy with a different ADC, patritumab deruxtecan, or HER3 DXD. Patients were enrolled who had a history of treated brain metastasis or untreated brain mets. There were a group of about 30 patients that had asymptomatic untreated brain metastasis with a response rate around 30%, which is similar to the response rate of the patritumab deruxtecan in the body. So there again, we think that we're seeing good signs of efficacy with more work that needs to be done.
Thank you, Dr. Johnson. I have to agree. I think initially when we started to see the CNS efficacy data emerge for ADCs in general, there was some surprise amongst the oncologists because it was not expected. Most recently at the ASCO annual meeting, we've also seen the report of some intracranial efficacy for a TROP2 targeted antibody drug conjugate, datopotamab deruxtecan. So as a community, I think we're really looking forward to seeing more CNS efficacy data emerge for these investigational therapies showing promise for patients with advanced lung cancer. Let me direct the next question to Dr. Bohr. With the existing and emerging options, how do we then decide on the optimal sequencing of different treatment options for intracranial efficacy in patients specifically with EGFR mutated non-small cell lung cancer?
Thanks so much for that question. It's truly a difficult question. So I would say that I'm going to bring up another topic here, which would be that topic of leptomeningeal metastasis. I bring it up firstly, because it's a little more prevalent in the group of patients harboring EGFR mutant lung cancer. And secondly, because the presence of a leptomeningeal metastasis really does alter quite a lot of our clinical decision-making. So I would say the short version is it sort of depends on what the scan looks like. If I see a scan from a patient, even if it's an asymptomatic patient, but the scan itself looks to me a little concerning for leptomeningeal metastasis. Let's say that the disease is very much on the surface of the brain and looks to be sort of crawling along the pleural surface. If we see patchy involvement of several surface areas of the brain, if I see evidence that there may be some slight increased intracranial pressure either on exam or in the scan, then I usually say, let's take a pause here and actually stage the entire central nervous system. Let's look at the spine, take a look at the spinal fluid, and really decide what we're dealing with here. If the patient is naive to all treatment and is a new diagnosis of non-small cell lung cancer and this EGFR, the easiest answer is, we'll start with a trial of osimertinib, of course, a really excellent third generation CNS penetrant agent. We'll give this a try, but we will have also at this point, if the patient does have leptomeningeal metastasis, have consulted our colleagues in radiation oncology. And the reason for this is that we do have very good evidence that for select patients that are less than the age of 70 and have an overall good otherwise KPS, such patients can benefit from proton craniospinal radiation. And when we kind of take a look at all of the data that we have, we think about osimertinib single dose, so 80 milligrams a day for a patient with EGFR mutant lung cancer. We see a PFS for such patients at about 7.2 months. And we see comparable results for a patient, same population of patients, getting proton craniospinal radiation. So the question then becomes one of sequencing, of course. Which goes first, the osimertinib or the radiation? And clearly, I'm a fan of starting with osimertinib and then kind of pivoting towards radiation later. I will say that I do counsel against whole brain radiation in these patients because the data are very clear comparing head-to-head, no pun intended, craniospinal radiation versus whole brain radiation. The overall survival and progression-free survival statistics are overwhelmingly in favor of treating the entire compartment. But proton craniospinal radiation is not available everywhere, of course. And there is this temptation to sort of pivot to perhaps photon-based craniospinal radiation. And I really can't counsel more strongly against that. The reason, of course, being of the toxicities, neither of these forms of radiation are going to cure the disease or going to completely eradicate the illness. And giving that dose of radiation to the spine really hampers your bone marrow and really kind of ties your hands as an oncologist. I would say I tend to start with targeted therapy. If there's a concern for leptomeningeal disease, I like to establish that first, and I like to give a trial of CNS penetrant agent first.
That's a great perspective. And I will add from the radiation side of things that I would totally agree and endorse starting with drug therapy if possible, because I share the enthusiasm to some degree about broad radiation to try to get rid of disease in the spinal compartment. But I also recognize that we're not going to get rid of it entirely. And even with protons, there still are side effects of treatment. And so I do reserve it for people with good KPS, as you said, but it's a good option to have. But I think it also really depends on the patient and their course. And I think starting with the drug and seeing how long they get durable response, often it can be a long time. And to me, even delaying large field radiation, delaying whole brain radiation or craniospinal radiation, these are all valuable endpoints that are sparing people toxicity of treatment. And so I think that's a valuable thing. I think that starting with that, and then depending on the clinical scenario, and depending, it really depends on the nature of patterns of failure in the CNS. So as Dr. Johnson was mentioning with her example, there are these people that will pop up a lesion here or there that we can salvage with radiosurgery, continuing them on their drug. I think if it happens more frequently, we look at things like the velocity of how often these are happening, then it may be time to think about another drug therapy. And I'll defer to our oncology colleagues about what those would be. But I think that in these patients, starting with the TKI first and seeing how the patient does from there is, in my view, the best way to approach it. I would also add that our practice in a large academic medical center in a city that's very easy to access both serial MRI scans and radiation options, I do think that depending on your practice location, this approach may vary. And so as we discussed kind of the frequency of getting scans, if we're taking a focal approach with radiosurgery or treating individual lesions, I think that it is important to recognize that it's not a one-size-fits-all situation. And so I think that we do see some differences in practice among community sites versus sort of more urban sort of places where they have more access to radiation. We do see more use of whole brain radiation in those settings because they don't have the ability to sort of get an MRI every 2 months as we might if we were really trying to be kind of survey the CNS very carefully. And so I think that's something else to consider depending on the practice of the people listening to this, that again, these options are there, but ultimately it's depends on the local situation and local teams as well.
I might underscore that just a little bit because I do practice in the community, but sort of at a different intersection. As we have launched our new practice in the last 9 months or so, we have been waging war with some of our payers in a new way. And I've learned how much of a struggle that can be at a place where you don't have the support to get the prior auth for the imaging. And so I've realized that is part of the reason that MR surveillance doesn't happen as frequently as it should. And isn't that a shame that it's so difficult to bring patients good care? So that's something I think this podcast can deliver the news that, especially for patients with oncogene-driven non-small cell lung cancer, we should be surveying more frequently than once a year or once every 6 months.
I agree. And I would hasten to add that this is the very reason it's important when your institution or your community asks for additions to the NCCN guidelines. As a community, we need to keep those NCCN guidelines up to date and reflective of practice because they're invaluable when we're asking, when we're dealing with payers, right? We really need documentation of our community standards and our practice so that we can get people what they need.
Dr. Lin, in your clinical experience, are there specific EGFR alterations that impact the effectiveness of ADCs for treating intracranial metastasis?
It's a really interesting question. In EGFR mutated lung cancer, we're starting to dig deeper into the molecular data. And we know from certain trials that, for example, the EGFR L858R substitution appears to be associated with worse prognosis compared to exon 19 deletion, for example. I would say when it comes to ADC therapies and their efficacy in general or CNS efficacy, how specific EGFR mutations impact that remains very much unknown. For now, in my practice, the data that are available do not support using versus not using antibody drug conjugates in patients based on the specific EGFR mutation that's identified.
Let's take it one step further. Across different oncogene drivers, I've wondered, is it something about the tumor itself Or is it something about the therapy that impacts the differential responses we see both to radiation and to TKI or radiation with ADC? Is it the soil or is it the seed that is impacting radionecrosis as an example? I think there are a lot of things we don't know, but I'm fascinated by that because it seems to happen without me being able to predict it.
I'm happy to weigh in here, although to share my ignorance as well, to some degree, I think these questions, and I'll speak maybe specifically to the radionecrosis question, just to take a step back, that's a late effect that we see from using high doses of radiation as we do with stereotactic radiosurgery, which is late increase in edema and sometimes enhancement around lesions that are treated. And when I say late, I usually mean anywhere from a few months to even years, even more than 5, 6, 7 years. I've seen evidence of patients who have changes in lesions that end up not being recurrent disease, but radionecrosis. And that often is a diagnostic dilemma because as of yet, we still do not have really any reliable tool to tell us, is this change in imaging disease or radionecrosis? And people have tried a lot of things and various techniques are used, but I would say none of them are totally reliable. And in terms of whether or not this is a seed or soil problem, we don't really know. We do know that we can see kind of mixed pictures of recurrence and necrosis. So there may be tumor-specific factors involved, but the best metrics we have still are dose parameter relationships of how much volume of brain is getting a certain dose, and we look at that. But it's a very crude thing that we are still sort of learning about. And I think I'm curious to hear Dr. Boire's view on this as well as a neuro-oncologist, because we often rely on our neuro-oncology colleagues to help us out in this situation, but I think we're all lacking some understanding.
Thanks for that. I have so many thoughts on this topic. I think that there's quite a lot of basic science that supports the idea that the tropism of individual cancer cells for individual sites in the body, that this is not driven by genomic changes, that this is really driven by epigenetic and transcriptional changes. There are conserved transcriptional changes that we find across different primaries that metastasize to the brain. And many of those transcriptional changes have to do with cancer cells adhering to the vascular endothelium of the brain, which is itself specialized. Entry into the brain, ability to interact productively with astrocytes, and even ability to interact with both astrocytes and neurons as part of the burgeoning field of cancer neuroscience. So it's pretty clear that how cancer cells interact with the central nervous system is very different than how they interact with other tissues in the body. And then, of course, by extension, their responses to treatment, even if we have, let's say, the same, if we have a great TKI that penetrates into the brain versus elsewhere, we're going to see different responses in the way the microenvironment responds to that treatment. It may be as simple as the way that the secretome of the cancer cell as it's dying changes a little bit, and that this alters the microenvironment, leading to more inflammation. And then when we hit with radiation as well, then we end up with a higher likelihood of radiation necrosis, and when we have these kind of combination treatment settings. And this also leads us stymied when we're asked, so how much time in between my favorite TKI and radiation to prevent radiation necrosis, which is just, I mean, that's magic eight ball level.
And Dr. Boire, a follow-up question to that, can we study this sequentially? The way we study this in the bloodstream, can you study this in the CSF? What do you learn from serial taps?
Yeah, I find that you can learn a lot from the spinal fluid. That might be an understatement. We love spinal fluid. I think my laboratory has t-shirts that say I heart CSF. So just know that we really love spinal fluid. You can learn a lot. That said, because the spinal fluid is in equilibrium with the interstitial fluid of the brain, it does provide us some information about what's happening in the brain. So serial collections can give us insight, and we certainly have the capacity to collect information about the inflammatory state of the brain over time.
I think that the other area of unknown is also how these ADCs impact the risk of radionecrosis. With all of these therapies, first with chemotherapy, then with TKIs, now with ADCs, we use radiation, but we often don't know how that radiation might interact with either therapies that are concurrently given or therapies that were given in the past, because we know that radionecrosis is a late effect. And so some of these changes happen, but are influenced by the drug therapies that have been received in the past. I think this is an area that we're still learning. There have been some reports on both sides of this question, some of which have suggested that it may be safe to do so, or they don't see increased rates of radionecrosis. Although recently there have been reports that suggest that it is more common. This may depend on the payload that's associated with the drug, may depend on the target, and it may depend on the individual. So as the numbers of patients increase who've received these drugs, I think we will see more and more data appearing that will help us guide people about how to combine these drugs. But for now, I think we do take it cautiously, but at least from my perspective, we haven't yet changed our approach of sequencing these things yet. But I think we are all very cognizant of the fact that we need to pay attention and follow these patients closely with our colleagues in medical oncology and neuro-oncology to look and see, and hopefully we will get more data on this in the upcoming years, but that it remains a concern. Dr. Barr, what additional questions remain that would further support the use of ADCs as a treatment option in clinical practice, and maybe get to the one of your areas of expertise, which is the use of these in leptomeningeal metastasis, and maybe some comments on that would be very interesting.
Thank you for that. And I wanted to kind of reiterate something that Dr. Johnson had already kind of opened the door to, which is that we don't know enough. We don't really know, these are enormous molecules, and we don't really know which bits of the molecules are really getting into the central nervous system. And I think that in and of itself is going to be wildly useful, because it will really help us understand how are these drugs working? And then, of course, how can we make them work better in the central nervous system? So I advocate for window of opportunity trials. And these are, of course, trials where we give patients a dose of the drug, patients who are going to go to the OR anyway for a resection of a brain metastasis. We give them a dose of the drug, sometimes several doses of drug first, and then we take them, resect the tumor, and then we're able to see clearly how much of the drug got to the tumor, what parts of the drug got to the tumor, was there on target activity, et cetera. And I think that's really going to give us a wealth of information. And sort of pivoting over into the equivalent question for leptomeningeal metastasis, perhaps the only silver lining of leptomeningeal metastasis is that we can collect spinal fluid from the patients, and that this allows us to be able to understand the disease course without a trip to the OR. So I advocate also for carrying out as many trials as possible, including patients with leptomeningeal metastasis. A trial that I designed with Helena Yu very recently used this approach, where all patients with radiographic disease, so patients who had progressive disease on osimertinib, so EGFR mutant lung cancer metastatic to the central nervous system, while on osimertinib, such patients were evaluable for the trial. And whether or not they had leptomeningeal metastasis did not determine their eligibility for the trial. Patients on entry for the trial received a lumbar puncture, and that lumbar puncture determined whether or not they were in arm A, sort of the power arm for the trial, parenchymal brain metastasis. And if they had positive CSF, then they were in arm B of the trial. Such a design allowed us to be able to ensure that the power arm was purely parenchymal brain metastasis so that we could get clean data. But it also afforded us the opportunity to collect spinal fluid serially on patients that were on trial, so that we're able to assess the penetration of these drugs, assess PK, PD, are we on target, all of these things in a population of patients that need lumbar punctures anyway. And I think that if we were to design ADC-based trials in a similar fashion, we could learn so much in relatively short order, and we'd be doing a great service for the patients harboring leptomeningeal metastasis.
That's a great trial. Can't wait. Congratulations to you and Dr. Yu, and we'll follow that with interest. Of course, HERTHENA-Lung02 also fully enrolled at this point, the pivotal phase 3 trial of HER3-DXd for patients who have been treated with osimertinib, randomized to patritumab deruxtecan versus carbo-pem pemetrexed, and this has CNS efficacy endpoints. So we'll have prospective data to help inform us as well. And that is also critical.
Yes, it is very nice to see more of these trials pursued. We need these well-designed clinical trials that are aimed at really dissecting the CNS efficacy of the investigational therapies. We cannot achieve that without the trials that incorporate CNS efficacy endpoints that integrate regular surveillance brain imaging throughout the study, and of course include patients that have brain metastasis or even leptomeningeal disease. And so we have to, as clinical trialists, we really have to advocate for more of these studies that are designed appropriately to address CNS activity.
I will also add that one of the things that has been encouraging, although not universal, has been to allow for salvage radiation in some of the patients, such that the drug may have pretty good CNS activity, but maybe you could have a good effect from the drug overall, but be able to salvage individual failures with radiation. And I think that's been something where people, drug trial sponsors, have been more accepting of. But frankly, for the patients, I think it's always very disheartening to hear that they're excluded because of a brain metastasis and can't get radiosurgery. And then we have to think about things like whole brain radiation to treat all the brain mets, even though we wouldn't have done that with our normal kind of practice pattern. So I think that's been something else I think that's been encouraging to see more of, but probably could be included in even more studies.
We stand at the entryway to new drugs and new opportunities, and having a multidisciplinary approach to our care is vital. Surveying brain metastasis, you've heard, also a very important part of the care for a patient with metastatic cancer. And finally, probably the intercalation, both effective systemic therapies with well-timed radiation or ablative therapies, I think will be our future state. So thank you for your time today in listening to our podcast. What other comments from the panel?
I will just say that it's been a pleasure to discuss this concept. And I think it sort of mimics what we see with the practice of brain metastasis that really is a multidisciplinary approach and one that we learn from each other about kind of the pros and cons of all of our therapies. And I think that is the way to try to maximize the benefits of our treatments and minimize the harms. And I think that it's been really amazing to see our medical oncology colleagues make such tremendous strides in treating brain metastases with drug therapies and then trying to integrate these therapies together. So I think that this podcast was an example of us all, at least for me, learning from you guys about your treatments. And I think that that's true when I see patients with brain metastasis in general.
We're in a really exciting era with rapid evolution in the treatment landscape for patients with lung cancer, including patients with brain metastasis. And I'm hopeful that these advances will continue in the coming years. As the advances continue, we'll be better poised to understand, are there markers of CNS response? Are there markers of CNS resistance that can help us improve on the existing options for our patients?
It's been such a pleasure to do this podcast together. I wanted to reiterate that, number one, that this really recapitulates my experience of caring for patients with CNS metastases. And it's one of the joys of caring for such patients is that I collaborate with a group full variety of intelligent physicians of very different specialties. And we all come together to solve one complex problem because each patient is a unique entity. And I would say also that something that's come up again and again during this podcast is the importance of research, both clinical research and basic science research, and really understanding the disease course. And that truly the more that we know and with better drugs, we can ask different questions. And I'm overwhelmingly thankful for my patients' bravery and selflessness, that I know we all have patients on trials, and it's remarkable what they do for the next patient.
You can listen to more podcasts by subscribing to ADIS Journal Podcasts with your preferred podcast provider or by visiting the journal website. For a full list of declarations, including funding and author disclosure statements and copyright information, please visit the article page on the journal website. The link to the article page can be found in the podcast description.